Welcome to the Virginia is for Laughers podcast, brought to you by the Funny Womax and Friends. If you're looking to get more out of your Shenandoah Valley experience, then this is the podcast for you. You'll meet interesting people, musicians, and comedians that perform here and find out more about what you can do and see. Whether you live here or plan to visit, listen to explore what makes our unique slice of heaven. Now here's your host, Don Davis Womack.
Hello, laughers. I am pumped to introduce you to today's guest. From NBC to Broadway, from the Netflix as a Joke Festival to writing for the Emmy-nominated The Problem with Jon Stewart, Kason Wilson is a powerhouse in comedy. He's shared the stage with legends, toured with Wanda Sykes, and made audiences laugh everywhere from True TV to the Kennedy Center. A proud Howard University grad and Jersey City native, Kason brings sharp wit, storytelling, and a whole lot of heart to the mic. Welcome to the show, Kason. It's great to have you on today.
Thank you. It is it's an absolute pleasure to be on. Thank you for having me. I couldn't be more excited to be here.
I couldn't be more excited for you to be here. We did a show together in Woodbridge for P.T. Bratton for Clean Comedy Connection, which was the first time we performed together. My husband was on that show. You remember that?
Yes, we did. That was fun.
Oh, wasn't that not hilarious? I could not. My sides hurt every time I listen to you. You are so talented. It is a blessing to know you, sir.
Well, thank you. I got to say, the Womax are some of my favorites. And the fact that you all get the opportunity to rebuttal each other on stage is probably the greatest. It's like the greatest couples therapy ever created. And I don't know why marriage therapists all over the country don't run an open mic for couples to be able to do that. And I also, the humility that it takes for you guys to decide who goes first, and who gets to get their grievances out last, I think is brilliant. And that is one of the shows, like every year you could look back, you're like, well, I know a lot of comics don't do this, but I mean, I don't know. But I go back and like, what are the shows that I'm like, what are my favorite memories from shows? Mm-hmm. You know, because you just, the comedy journeys can just be such a weird one.
Yes.
That's one of the ones back and I'm like, that was a fun night. I won't forget that night.
Me either. It was really, really special. And I believe that night, that night we did solo performances and we do duo performances now. So we might bust that out. In fact, that's actually what we are doing, a duo set. When you come here March 28th at the Sipe Center in Bridgewater, you'll get to experience us there on stage at the same time doing that.
I can't wait. That's something that if I were not already on the show, I would pay to see.
And it feels a little bit weird to us. We were talking about that too, because we both started out as solo performers. So now as a duo act, it's newer. And we just kind of talk about how it feels like being a newer comic as a duo, because that's not as experienced as we are as solo people. But yet the benefits of being on there together with the chemistry, way more benefits than we thought it was going to be. You know, it's in ways it's easier. So
I would imagine the courage that it takes to do that is unfathomable, because in my head, if my wife and I did comedy together, I would never be able to engage in confrontation, because I would just be afraid that every time we argue, I would look in your eyes and I know you were thinking, oh, I can't wait for this to go in the set.
And we do that.
Like, remember that thing you were mad about? That would be so funny. This is how we work on stage. And I'm like, this is for our marriage counselor. This is not for the whole city to hear. I can't wait to see that.
Yeah, it's gonna be a lot of fun. We're gonna go up before you, and then we have a young man who, his name is Sam Spears. He took our comedy class and he's out there on the circuit now, and it's gonna be his first big host gig, and so I'm excited about that. Yeah. I'm excited that for him. He's gonna do a great job, so, and I'm excited to meet you.
Do you remember your first big show?
My first big show. Gosh, I'm thinking of recent bigger shows. My first big show. Ah, Court Square Theater. Yep.
Ooh.
So when we started our series, first comedy series at Court Square Theater, it's 250 seats here in Harrisonburg, Virginia. And they brought us on to do that. And that's been quite a ride, too. That was really great. We enjoyed that. Ooh. Yeah.
Okay.
What about with you? What was your first? Do you remember your first big show?
Ooh. Okay. So I'm going to say, and I don't know if I've ever said this. I've never said this out loud before, but this is probably, I will say, my most important show. Is it the biggest or most influential in my career? No. But the biggest, is when I first started out in comedy, I think my first or second year.
Yeah.
My aunt asked me to do 10 minutes at our family reunion banquet.
Okay. Which,
family reunion is a very big deal. We're on our 66th annual family reunion every Labor Day weekend. It's a big deal. But it was also the first time that I ever performed in front of my grandmother.
Oh, my goodness. And yeah.
That, and our relationship is like close enough to where if she was like, didn't laugh, I probably would not have continued doing comedy. It was great. I had a lot of fun, and you know, mostly just doing jokes about stuff happening that weekend, family. I threw a couple of jokes I had written, you know, 1 or 2 years in. It was just very D-minus jokes I was writing at that time. But I got off stage, and my grandmother pulled me close, and she was like, "Yeah, I think you should do comedy." And that was like the moment that I actually went from something that I really enjoyed doing to something that I was like, I want to do this professionally. So I would say like that's my first big show. So see you soon, Sam Spears.
Indeed. Yeah. Before we get into this, couple things, I just want to tell the laughers real quick. I've got some great fun news for you because now Audible, big thanks to them for supporting this show. And as a result, you can get a free audiobook when you sign up for a 30-day trial. So you just hit that link in the show notes. And then that way, between episodes, you don't have to listen to me all the time. You can support this podcast by finding somebody else you want to listen to. So give that a whirl. Also, we normally interview our guests, because this is a podcast about all things non-hiking in the Shenandoah Valley. We normally go to our guests and where they are, but we also interview entertainers that come here to perform for us, like you, Kason. So I want to share with people where you are sitting right now. I will tell the laughers, if you're listening or watching, where I am right now is in my home office, which is down here in our guest bedroom in the corner. And so that is in Harrisonburg, Virginia. And where are you, Kason, at this moment?
I'm also in your home office. No, I'm joking. I am in my home office in Los Angeles, California.
Okay. But you are not LA native. No, you are from New Jersey.
Jersey City, New Jersey, born and raised.
Okay.
On the playgrounds where I spent most of my days. Yeah, I grew up in New Jersey. I went to high school in Delaware and then ended up in D.C. At Howard University. And that's where I started comedy.
Wow. Now, how are you doing out there in L.A.? There has been unfortunate loss, big loss with the fires out there. Did that affect you at all? Are you and your family okay? Did you have to evacuate? What did that look like for you?
Yeah, so that's sort of a two sides of the coin kind of a thing. Were we impacted directly? No, thank God. At the time, I was in Delaware with my mom, who was going through some health challenges. So I was in Delaware watching everything. But you know, it was really, really scary. It was, you know, looking through like the home camera during the day, and you can start to see the clouds, like you start to see it get a little darker, and kind of, you know, being in the evacuation zone and kind of waiting refreshing every second to find out So fortunately, we weren't directly connected, but also are connected to people whose lives have been like irreparably impacted by the fires. And, you know, not, you know, if your house doesn't burn down, but like your kid's school burns down. So now you have to figure out virtual learning. And, you know, just hearing, you know, associates and comics that I know who lost everything. And, you know, even the people who I know who may, you may look at as financially well off, but, you know, lost like pictures of relatives that you can't get those pictures back, or the wall where you charted how tall your kid was getting by the year. Like that wall is gone now. And, you know, we, when I got back to LA, had a chance to drive through like Altadena and some of the Palisades, and it was overwhelming in a way that is hard to quantify. That was, it was tough to see that and to think through all the damage, for sure.
How do you feel people are doing out there now? What's the feeling right now? It's been, what, a few weeks now since it began. And I imagine it still looks, from pictures and videos from here in Virginia, it looks pretty apocalyptic still in a lot of places.
Yeah, when I was driving through, it didn't feel like I was in America, is the way that I described it. It just felt like something I had watched on TV, and it was hard to. Can I tell you the part that felt weird? And I know this is to everyone listening, like, this is gonna sound wild because it just sounds, it doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. But like you hear about this devastation, and then you expect to see, you know, just this, you know, whatever you assume the land is going to look like after a devastation like that. Mm-hmm. But the chimneys were all still standing.
Oh, wow.
And for some reason, that was like more jarring than anything. It's just like watching just like acres and acres, like blocks and miles of devastation. And, you know, the National Guard is there. A lot of people don't know that, but the National Guard is there. If that's like a government secret, editor, please take that out. But
I don't know if it is or not.
But like the National Guard is there, and then you're driving through blocks and seeing like cars gone and like whole houses gone. And then like the two things that like stand out that you see that's like really interesting and, you know, make you really feel is one, you see, every now and then you would see like a car and people standing outside and just walking through, and you realize that, you know, people evacuated and got their families out of there and are watching all of that they love like go away. And then you're seeing in real time people coming back to just like witness their houses gone, you know? So you're watching people like trying to pick through stuff to see if anything made it and all of that stuff. And then what is also really interesting is that you would see, let's say, like a half mile block of houses like decimated. And then like in the middle of the block, you would see like one house that's like fully functional, didn't get that touched at all.
Right. I saw that from here, too. That's so strange. Yeah.
So it's like watching and you see like the lights are on, they're inside. Like you could like see them like walking the dog, or like if the window's big enough, you could like kind of see them like watching TV in the house. And it's just like, I just, the idea
surreal.
That
yeah.
Your entire community is gone. It's like you and then like a Quiznos or like a Subway 2 miles down, like it's the only thing that is still standing. So it's like things like that, that just remind you. But then again, then like the Grammys happen a week later, and you're like, that's the thing about LA that's like hard to quantify, that like something like that will happen, and then they'll like have the Grammys, and then you'll be like, Kendrick won 5 times. And it's like, yeah, but like all the people who are like cheering him on lost their house. So it's like LA is like very, very different in that way, because there's something like so celebratory about it. And it's like ability to be strong and move on, but also like, you know, it's also like these are terrible things that are happening here, but also like great things as well. So it's just, it's really interesting living in a place that like kind of lives in both worlds.
You know, that's true. Also, one of the poignant points my main therapist gave me, Boss Babe, is that every day is grief and gratitude. So it's an extension of that. I think we all go through that on various levels, depending on season of life, what's happening around us, what's going on in the environment, just life in general. There's something that you're losing and then something you're gaining at the same time. And you guys are experiencing that on a very big level right now.
Yeah, like in New Jersey, that would never, if there was a fire of that magnitude in New Jersey, like we wouldn't be having a comedy show that night.
I know. And see, but maybe a comedy show is good. And
no, it's great. It's great.
And I'm the devastation. Saying, like, yeah, you're saying that, you know, it approaches
LA is just
different.
Like in that place where I see. Like, yeah, like, hey, if your house burned down, come, you can get 20% off. You're like, wait, what? Like, I guess it's just LA, you know, but LA is, if you look at historically, LA has just like been through so much that there's just like a natural turnover of like, all right, we could make it. This is how we survive. It's such a big city, too. So
that's what I was thinking about. I wonder if part of it is just the sheer volume of people in the area, that if you didn't, what would you do? If you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean,
it'd be kind of
Jersey
strange.
Jersey City burned down. Yeah. If Jersey City burned down, Bruce Springsteen would have to come and sing Hope back into the city. Like, that's what it would take. Like, we would not have another comedy show until the weather broke. Like, we would.
There would be a state of mourning going on.
Oh, yeah. The next comedy show would be for 4th of July. Like, we would, there would be no. But it's, you know, it's. There's something very redeeming about being in a place that can live in both, but also just being able to appreciate. And then nowadays it's hard to focus on one tragedy. That's the other thing. It's like, it's so much going on.
Yes.
You know, it's partly because of the times, but also partly because of social media. You just have access to every bad thing in the world.
Like, I know, on steroids.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm just like, back in the day, like, even in when I was growing up, like in the 90s, our newspaper was called the Jersey Journal. And if you wanted to go to the store and get a magazine, then you could. But like Jersey City, the Jersey Journal was like, hey, a pothole tore up 8 tires last week. And that was the worst thing you had access to. And if you want to get the Post or the New York Times, you could like find out about the rest of the world. But like on social media, like as soon as I'm like my thoughts and prayers or with everyone in the fire, hashtag tragedy. And then you click hashtag tragedy and then like the world's tragedies are your oyster. You know what I mean? Like now I have access to every bad thing in the world. So there's also like a part of it that's like, man, I wish. Can I just get 2 days with this tragedy, please, before we add more?
More. 1,000 more. Yeah.
Yeah, like I just like to focus on one tragedy. I'd like think if all the tragedy can get in a single file line, I really appreciate it.
Yeah. It's true, though. It's a different time because things could be going on even before newspapers. Can you imagine things were going on all over the world? You just never heard about it because it wasn't available, you know?
Yeah.
Like until it showed up in your village. Then you knew.
If you didn't check your mail, you didn't know tragedy was afoot. You know what I mean?
Like, right. Yeah, and like, think about mail. Like they didn't have mail, and I don't think the 400s. They sent messengers, and they would. I think that's where the marathon came from.
Yeah,
because they would send a messenger out, and then they would send.
Yeah, imagine if your messenger overslept.
That could like be good or very, very bad.
I think all of that kind of wraps into one. But yes, I am in Los Angeles, and I am traveling from Los Angeles to Virginia to be with you all, and I couldn't be more excited for that.
I can't wait for that too. You went to Howard University, and I understand, is that where your comedy journey started? Somebody, one of your mentors at the school, suggested you do this? Can you tell us about that?
Sure, 100%. So I was a theater major at Howard University, HU, you know, all that stuff, and in Washington, D.C., yeah. And my professor, acting coach, my acting professor, my last 2 years was Professor Al Freeman Jr., the late, great Al Freeman Jr., who most people would recognize if you've seen Spike Lee's Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. He played the Honorable Elijah Muhammad opposite Denzel Washington.
Okay.
So he's a legend. I mean, like, people, if you search him and knew his name, like, he is an absolute legend. He's my acting coach. And, you know, I think as a facilitator yourself, you may mm-hmm. understand this.
Yeah.
But he gave us a assignment our junior year to produce a one-man show.
Oh, wow.
You know, because his whole idea was, you know, as an actor, you can live with and I can help you and teach you how to be better at interpreting other people's text. But you have to be able to write for yourself and produce for yourself. You have to have an eye that's mm-hmm. bigger than the eye of what you think you want to do right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to produce a one man show. And what we would do in class, like Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, or whenever the class was, is we would do 10-minute excerpts of the one man show every class.
Mm-hmm.
So it was my time to do my excerpt, and I did it, and yeah. I was like waiting for notes. And you know that moment where you're just like, you know, the moment where like the gymnasts put their hands in the air and they turn all yeah. the sides, and all,
yeah.
like that's what that moment was. And I was sort of waiting to hear notes. And Professor Freeman lit a cigarette and just walked out and left me standing there. And probably the most vulnerable I've ever been in my life. He just lit a cigarette and walked out and left and took okay. a smoke break.
All right.
And, you know, is that good? Is that bad?
That's what I was thinking. How are you feeling? Did you?
Am I purged from the system?
Right. Right.
Yeah. I felt the way anyone feels on a first date where you're like, hey, I had a great time. Yeah. Would you want to go out on a second date? Yeah. Just imagine someone lit a cigarette and walked away. That's exactly how
I'd be like, was that? That may have been bad. I don't know. Yeah.
So after like 10, 20 minutes, he came back and explained that I was getting an F for the class that day.
Really?
But told me to see him after class. And I went to him after class, and he explained that the reason why I was getting a low grade wasn't because it was bad. It was actually really funny, but it wasn't a one-man show. He thought that it was closer to stand-up comedy.
Ah.
And I was like, but no, I had a character, and he had a backstory, and this was moment before, and this is, and he was like, no, I understand. Yeah. But like the way you move through it and the way you wrote it, it feels like stand-up comedy. And we went back and forth about it. And he was like, well, if you don't believe me, why don't you go to a stand-up comedy club, go to open mic, and perform what you did in class, and let me know how it goes.
Oh.
So I went to, the next day, I went to the Riot Act Comedy Club with the urging of one of my classmates, Kyle Jones. Mm-hmm. Shout out, Kyle. And I went to Riot Act Comedy Club, 14th Street in Washington, D.C., and did what I did in class,
mm-hmm.
and it was great.
Really?
It was great.
And people were laughing. You had a great time.
I had a great time.
Felt good.
Felt great.
Yeah.
Went to class the next day, and he said, how did it go?
Yeah.
And I said, it was great. And he said, right, because it was stand-up comedy. And he said, I think it'll be a great move for you. And in his wisdom, which I credit him all the time for the reason I got into stand-up comedy, he adjusted the class so that my one-man show could be 45 minutes of stand-up that semester.
Wow.
Well, 30 minutes of stand-up, but he adjusted the class for me to be able to
do that. Like,
work on stand-up as a craft, as a part of the class. So I credit so much of what I was able to do and me able to view stand-up comedy as like a serious profession and serious craft from the late, great Al Freeman Jr. at Howard University. It's an absolute true story.
That's amazing. It makes me want to cry because it's such a testimony to his great skill of being a teacher. And when you are really about the student, you make in their learning, you make decisions like that when you see like their specific abilities and talents and passions, rather than pushing them in a way to conform to what you want. You want to empower them to do what they're gifted to do. And he didn't have to do that. And the fact that he did that is a true testimony to him being an incredible teacher.
100%.
Yeah.
He saw it before I saw it.
And mentor. Yeah.
100%. And it's like that is the power of just being able to see, for people to just see past what you see. Because I literally had never considered stand-up comedy, even though I'll probably watch it every night. There was nothing in my head that said this, something that I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And but he saw it, and I literally from that day been doing it ever since.
I know, and you do such a good job. You've performed so many different places. I'm sure you've performed to maybe some small crowds, but also obviously big crowds at the Kennedy Center. So do you make adjustments from smaller to larger crowds or types of venues or not? What does that look like for you?
That's a great question. It's an interesting one. I'll give two answers on that front.
Okay.
One, I think because I have such a theater background, we are always taught to perform for the back of the room.
Yep.
And that's like, you know, like I am a big energy person on stage and I like to have a good time. But a lot of that is not like who I am as a person. It's really just because like theater and even like growing up in church and having to be in the front in the church all the time, I was always like comfortable being out in front. Mm-hmm. But also theater training is like, you know, until I started stand-up comedy, all my performing was with no microphone. Mm-hmm. So it was like
projection.
Hey,
yeah.
Here is 600 people. The person in the very, very back who paid what they could needs to feel like you are overpowering them the same way the person in the front row does.
Mm-hmm.
So that was like so much of what so much of like my approach to art was. So it just kind of naturally like flowed into stand-up comedy. But it's also, I guess the second thing I would say is material-wise, do I change things? Like, no. But my first time, I'll tell you this, but like my first time, it's also, I don't know why, but this podcast, I'm just saying things I never said out loud. But my first time performing in a theater of any magnitude, like over 2,000 people, was I did JFL in Vancouver.
What's JFL?
Oh, Just for Laughs.
Okay, all right.
Just for Laughs. It is a huge, huge festival in the comedy world. Think Megafest for comedy is exactly is essentially what it is. It was, I think, 3,000 people or something like that in Vancouver. And I walked on stage and realized I couldn't see any of those people. It was
because
the darkest.
It was dark? Okay.
It was just one spotlight on me and the rest of the room was pitch black.
Wow.
It just felt like you get laughs from people you can't see. It's just like so jarring. It gave me such more of an appreciation for comics. But in terms of approach, it's like there isn't anybody to play off of. Mm. So it's, you really have to trust the material. You really have to like get into it. You really have to be in tune with the timing. It's like, it was my first time saying a joke. And then like, because I'm in a comedy club, I'm like, oh, I don't hear anything. Let me move on to the next thing. Mm-hmm. And then you get like these waves of laugh. And it's like, oh yeah. Cause the laughs are coming from 3,000 people away. The pacing is different. The timing is different. You really have to trust the material. I wouldn't say there's any like different approach, but I think, you know, yeah, we do. When you start out in comedy, you might be performing in a bar with 10 other comics who truly are only thinking about their own jokes and waiting for you to be quiet so they can have their turn.
Yeah.
And I think being able to go to different spaces where people who are, it was very humbling. It gave me a different appreciation for the craft and seeing it in different spaces, and then watching Wanda Sykes like walk through her material. It gave me such more of an appreciation for how people who do theaters regularly are able to approach it. But my approach isn't necessarily different comedically, but there is a difference, and I didn't know that until I was in those spaces.
Wow. Speaking of Wanda Sykes, is that you were on tour with her? Is that where you made your first connection with Wanda Sykes, and how you ultimately ended up on tour with her? Is through that connection on Just for Laughs, or?
So actually, no. We had been connected several times before that.
Really?
Yeah. So the last season of NBC's Last Comic Standing.
Okay.
Wanda Sykes was the executive producer. Wanda and Paige Hurwitz were executive producers of Last Comic Standing. I was actually on that season.
Okay.
And that's the way that that's also like a crazy story. I don't know if you have time for it, but
yeah, we're going to talk about Last Comic Standing for sure, but you go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. So Last Comic Standing was wild. It was my first time ever doing TV. All right, here's the story.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Wanda Sykes and Paige Hurwitz produced the last season of Last Comic Standing. And one thing that they have to get credit for that a lot of times they don't, one, their ability to innovate as artists is so underrated. Even more credit as being like women in this industry and being able to innovate in that way every single time. You know, a lot of people don't remember, but Last Comic Standing was much more like American Idol, Sunday's Best kind of a show, where you like stood outside in line and, you know, you stood in front of the panelists and got a chance to do your jokes and stuff, which there's absolute value to shows like that. But when they came on the scene, they were like, hey, we want to give comics a shot who are like doing really well in their scene and people just don't know them. So, you know, like somebody who's been doing, who just, you know, wants to try comedy because it's a big national TV show, and somebody who's been doing comedy for 20 years are in the same line waiting for 12 hours to be seen. So they actually like contacted comedy clubs throughout the country and was like, give us your best 20 people.
Wow, that's a great approach.
And we'll come to those auditions.
Okay.
And we'll tape them and then we'll watch it from there. So like, who is killing it in the clubs? Like who are your hosts? Who are your features? Who are bubbling in terms of headliners? Like, send us those people.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fortunate enough to be in that number with the amazing DC Improv and Antoine. Like, the staff there is absolutely incredible. And I did my audition at the DC Improv in the lounge. And I got, and at the time I'm working at NIH. I was working for the government.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. So, well, yeah, nobody. Again, something I've never said out loud, but I was an accountant clerk for NI for 7 years.
An accountant?
Yeah. Clerk.
Clerk. I just want to be very clear. Let's not get too out of ourselves, Dawn.
Clerk.
Okay. Got you.
I do not have a pension, at the least. Okay. When they were ready to make cuts, I certainly was, I was the first ballot Hall of Famer to get cut. I was working at NIH at the time and I got an email saying, I got a call from an unlisted number. And as somebody who never answers that, I have no idea why. It had to be the Holy Spirit. When I say Dawn, it had to be the Holy Spirit. I don't call anybody who could ask for money, like especially strangers. Like, right. I'm like, people who call from unlisted numbers are strangers who want my money. Those are not calls I take. But for some reason, I just answered the call. And it was like, whoever was on the other side of the phone was like, hey, we're from NBC Last Comic Standing. And I hung up. Because I was like,
you didn't believe it.
Well, in my head, this is just such an ignorant industry thing. Like now I understand that, like, hey, industry people will call from an unlisted number just because that's like a thing. Mm-hmm. But at the time I was like, why would NBC call me from a fake number? I'm already thinking this call isn't real.
Mm-hmm.
So I just hung up. And then I got an email. I got an email saying,
they're like, saying, why did you hang up on me?
It was like, but you know, it was like the cool industry version of that. Like, hey, I think we had a connection issue. So, so it was like, hey, at your convenience, can you call? And then I like looked at the email address and I was like, oh no, this isn't fake. So I called the number back and they were like, hey, we want to invite you to callbacks. So the thing, all right, so this is like the second part of the story. So let's say I do the audition in April.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get this call until like July, maybe. And they have like invitationals. So the callbacks are like the last thing before you go on the show. But before the step after your first auditions is like the invitationals. And then you do mm-hmm. callbacks and then you do the show. I had so many friends who got invited to an invitational in New York and they got called back like a week or two later. Like, hey, we're doing like a round two mm-hmm. of all the comics who did auditions, everyone on the East Coast or let's say like Virginia and above, they're all going to New York. Everybody from Chicago's coming to New York. They're going to do mm-hmm. the round two. So in that time, I'm like, oh, I didn't get an invitation to round two. Mm-hmm. Like I didn't make the cut and I'm like sincerely sense. Happy for all my friends and all these like great comics. And the show that I did is like heavy hitter. So I'm like, oh, being on that show, you could roll the dice and any five people from that show could have made it. And they did like mm-hmm. four shows that weekend. So I was like, just grateful to have the opportunity and had completely settled that like, oh, I didn't make the cut because mm-hmm. all these people are in New York. And then that show goes by and then you're like, oh, well, I don't know what happens next.
Mm-hmm.
So I get the call. The call is telling me basically that I wasn't invited to New York because I was actually going straight to round three in LA.
Wow.
So, yeah, I wasn't participating in like the invitational that everyone was doing in New York. I was just going to go straight to the LA auditions.
That's pretty baller.
Which was
so
humbling. And I screamed out loud in the middle of a government office to the point that security was called. Like, that's how loud I screamed. Because like, you just can't scream like that in a government building and people think it's okay. So I had to like explain, like, oh no, everything's okay. I'm just gonna probably need a couple days off. So I got to New York, got to LA, and I had no idea, like, hey, just prepare 5 minutes. Like, mm-hmm. you know, just prepare 5 minutes and go for it from there. No idea who's gonna be there or whatever. And I knew Wanda went to Hampton mm-hmm. University and I went to Howard, which is like a thing. And so I wore a Howard sweatshirt to the audition, thinking like, oh, maybe if they record this, like she'll see it. And you know, that'll be like a cool thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I wore my Howard sweatshirt and the auditions worked out in a way where you can't like see what going on. It's like in the middle of the day, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You walk on stage, there's no one there, there's no stage, there's no crowd. It's not a show. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You're going on stage with a microphone, and there are just four people in the back in a stool watching the show. There are no chairs set up, no crowd. Like, there is not, I cannot explain this enough. This is not a traditional show. There's no one in the room.
It's like, if you ever seen the movie Flashdance, it's like Flashdance comedy.
Yes.
Right?
100%.
Yeah.
100%. It gives that American Idol feel. Like, it's just
got it.
In the room. So I walk on stage and then all I hear is, okay, Howard University. And I look through and it's Wanda sitting there.
What? And
immediately, you know, in my head, I'm like, okay. Okay. Like, this could have been like interns just filming it. Like, no. Paige and Wanda and execs all sitting there and they watched the set and did my audition and did my 5 minutes. They said, thank you so much. Held their hand up. Thank you so much. We'll be reaching out. And then I get off stage and then one of the production assistants leads me to the door.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, thank you for your time. Have a great day. And I go out the door. And as soon as I get out the door, I realize I'm outside. Like, that was it. Like, there wasn't
it.
it wasn't like go back to a room and find out. It was just like, I went, he was like, hey, want come through this door right here. Yeah. And I walked out the door and I was like, oh, this is outside. Like, that's it.
That's
like,
it. You're done.
I can just go back. I can go back to Maryland. And like, they had really just happened that fast.
Wow.
And then went home and yeah, like shortly after that, I found out that I hadn't been invited on the show. I made it on to NBC's Last Comic Standing and got a tape date and flew back out to LA and was able to tape the show. And it was just like incredible. Like, Anthony Jeselnik hosted, and it was Keenan Ivory Wayans, Roseanne, and late Norm Macdonald were the hosts, were the judges.
Wow.
And did my set, and I didn't necessarily like the set that I did. Like, it wasn't like this transcendent first TV performance. Like, it was, I guess looking back on it, I just wasn't like, it wasn't my best. Mm-hmm. And Wanda was like the first person I saw after I got off stage wearing a headset and was able to be like, hey, you know, when you do TV, why don't you try this? And it went, like, okay. Really, like, kind of gave me a lot of great advice. Like,
yeah,
you know, like, hey, you know, when you do TV, people want to get to know who you are as a person. They want to know you. Mm-hmm. So, like, maybe doing one long joke about Black schools isn't the best way to get to know you as a person. Like,
I see. A little bit of this, a little bit more of a buffet of what is my personality and what am I about. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah. And when they go to the clubs, that's where you go to be funny. And then TV is where you go to be known. And she kind of hit me to that side of the world. And I think our relationship has been like great since then, and done a couple other things with them. And then, you know, but the tour was like the first time stand up wise, like, I was able to like actually feature for her.
That's great. How amazing.
It was one of the greatest experiences of my life. Like, I'll never forget that time for sure.
I love that she took an interest in you and saw something in you. That keeps happening to you.
You know?
You know?
But I think that's why, like, people are probably always tired of me saying it, but there's so much of my career that I owe to people who had no reason to help me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I mean, Professor Freeman, I was paying him, but, you know.
But, thousands of dollars to hear him talk.
But you could have just coasted. Yeah. You could have just coasted and let me do what I was doing. And true. He changed the course of my career. Like, to change the course of my career and then to adjust the whole class to make sure what you saw in me had a chance to be like to grow and be watered and grow is like, and I have truly every step of my career, like, have I worked hard and all of those things? Like, sure, I've done a lot of stuff I'm proud of, but there's so many areas of my career and my life where I can clearly say, like, there was someone who helped pave that road, and I did everything I could to walk down it and run it and make the most of it. But I would not be here where I was today. I wouldn't be here where I am today without, like, all of these amazing people, like, setting the road for me.
Mm-hmm. I think that's important to share, too, because then you'll be given opportunities to do that for someone else and pay it forward. That's how we all help each other move forward and get places, you know, by seeing 100%. That in someone in them and empowering them and encouraging them and then opening some doors for them. When you see that, it makes all the difference in the world. And then look how much it blesses other people. Now we get to enjoy this amazing comedy. If they didn't do that, we wouldn't get to hear you. And that would be a travesty. Yeah. Hashtag tragedy.
That's right. Let's lighten the hashtag up. Yeah.
That's a callback right there, you know.
That's who don't know. Honestly, well done.
Well, thank you.
There's no topping that one. Hashtag tragedy.
I want to know, before I switch topics, in that room when there was the four of them and it turned out to be Wanda Sykes in the back of the room, you were doing that 5 minutes. Were you just zero laughs that entire 5 minutes and you just powered through? Did they laugh at all? Were there any laughs or were they quiet? Do you remember?
Honestly, amazing question. I do remember. It was They laughed, but it was four, maybe five people laughing.
So it's not a lot. Okay, cool.
It was a room built for 300-400 people. It was at the old John Levitt's Comedy Club.
Okay.
In Universal Studios City Walk. Mm-hmm. And it was probably a room built for, I would say, 300-400 people, and it was just four or five people in the back. I don't remember killing. How about that? I don't remember being like, "Woo, they cannot stay in that stool. They are losing it back there." But I do. It wasn't like I didn't bomb. Like, I don't remember. Here's the thing. There are a few moments in my life where I can honestly say I was so nervous. I don't remember anything.
Got you. Yeah.
Like, there have been times, I don't know if you had this moment, but there are times where I've got off stage and somebody be like, "How did it go?" And I'm like, "I don't know. I don't know. I have no idea. I'm just happy it's over." Like, I truly, you can ask me any detail from that night. I could not tell you one. I could watch the footage back and I'm like, "Didn't even remember I said that." Oh, that's fine. Like,
that's all right.
The people seem to enjoy it. That's great. But that's one of those moments where, like, they laughed, and whatever I did, it was good enough to get me on the show.
Yeah.
But, like, there are times where I am so in my head or so nervous or so, like, I hope this goes well, that if you could have told me, Michael Jackson had came back and was sitting on the other side of that room, and I wouldn't have noticed. I don't know.
Jackson, who?
Yeah, right. Like, Andrew Jackson. It could be Eddie Jackson. I would have never known. It was but I remember a laugh, but there was I was so nervous and scared and all of those things that I truly couldn't give you a play by play of anything that happened that day.
But you made it. How did you end up in Last Comic Standing? How far did you get or do? Or how did that all
I made it to? So I did top 100, which basically means I made it onto the show. I did not move on to the next round. I'm on the first episode, but like on the section where they're like, "Here are some quick quibs." Like, that's the part of the show I was on. Because like the first episode is really like introducing you to the people who they already know made it to the next round.
I got it. Okay.
So I made it onto the montage where they're like, "Hey, before we show you a Charmin commercial, here's this."
Yeah.
And so that's the part of the show I was on. And I didn't watch it. So I haven't seen it to this day, really.
Really?
But anytime I've been on TV, I have not watched it one time. I can't.
Oh, that is so crazy. The guy who played, oh my gosh, Kylo Ren. What is his actual name? You know what I'm talking about. Star Wars, Kylo Ren. Oh, he doesn't watch his either. Never watches his.
I get it, because I can't. Yeah. I'm already self-conscious enough.
Yeah.
It's not. I'm the type of person that have the performance of my life and then be like, "Why did I say it like that?" Or like, "Why does my shirt look like that?" Or, "I should have steamed my shirt one more time." Like,
it's how like, come no, I didn't go to the gym five more times?
You know what I mean?
You know what I mean? I do. Yeah.
Especially when you like buy a shirt for a show and you're like, "Oh, I'm going to lose 20 pounds before this show." And then you don't. And then it's like, "Well, I'm still going to wear that shirt."
That's right.
And then you wear it. And like, I knew I was gaining too much weight when my shirt had a shadow. That's when I was like, "All right, it's probably time to stop going to Five Guys for a while." And that's, you know, I actually try not to watch. I usually just don't watch anything. I don't think I've watched any TV appearance I've ever done, just because it's better for me to just let it be what it is. But people have like sent it. My whole family was so proud of me. They really celebrated that moment. And I got so many calls and text messages. So I've seen a clip, but I never like watched the actual show.
Does that mean too that you don't go back and watch your videos of your sets that you've done too? Do you do any of that? Do you record them and watch them back of your comedy sets? Okay.
But
it's different to you when you do that than watching you on TV. Okay. Tell me why.
It is one, I'm watching sets back to edit jokes. So I don't. Well, let me just say this. When I'm watching, when I do watch myself back, it is to work on jokes and to write them better and to get them to like see what else I can have fun with or what I can delve into more, what I can take out, what I can't. Just editing. That's one. Two, I don't necessarily watch them. I'll just like kind of listen to them or, you know, if there's like a fun crowd work moment or if I'm trying to like maybe edit it and put it out, maybe I'll do that. But that's about it. Like other than that, I'm just like not watching anything.
So you're doing it for the mechanics so that you can improve your material and make it punchier, find some more tags.
Yeah.
Maybe with some more callbacks. Yeah.
The only thing that I do watch, and this is so embarrassing to say, but the only thing I do watch, I have a Google Drive of like 10 shows that I do watch back. But it's like, I call it like the hard times. And anytime where I'm like, anytime it's like bad or I'm like, oh, why am I still doing comedy or times get rough? I just go back and watch those because they're not like the best shows I've ever done, but some of them are like really early on and some of them are just like the most fun I've had on. Like, it's like, oh, that's what I look like when I'm having fun on stage, or this is a time where I was just doing comedy for the love of it. Like, it wasn't about ticket sales. It wasn't about, like, this is what I'm like, because I always just like want to be that person. Like, I just want to have fun and have a good time and remember that like this is supposed to be fun. This is supposed to be like, so like that I have like sets of those in my phone that every now and again, like when I'm like I'm getting too deep in the woods, like I know where to go to like watch, like maybe 6 months in being like blah, 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 blah. But it was just like I was having the time of my life up there telling terrible, horrible jokes. Like, I don't know if you had this moment, but when I watched myself when I first started, I don't necessarily enjoy it. I'm like judging the audience. Like, why are you laughing at that?
I know that you mean.
What is, where, do you people have no standards? Why are you laughing at me back then? But it also was just like, oh yeah, I'm free and creating and having fun and throwing tags out. Like that's, you know, I think the culture of comedy, comedians, audience members, some, we've all lost a little bit of like, hey, we're all here to have a good time. Like we can talk about all, like the subject matter may stay the same and maybe we could all talk about really tough stuff and all the stuff we see going on in our world. But like, hey, like, well, we can have fun. We can be silly and enjoy ourselves. Like this doesn't have to be like a town hall meeting every time.
Mm-mm. We can
actually have a good time. So I do watch those back, but that's about it you're going to get from me. Other than that, those shows and that footage can stay right where it's at. After I worked on that joke, delete, get out of here.
That's it. So then I know one of those videos that you have on your phone has got to be from the Clean Comedy Connection in Woodbridge with us, right?
Oh, yeah. That was 100%. 100%.
I know, like, PT sent those, so.
Oh, I was willing to stand on his doorstep to get that video. So for those who weren't at the show, there was that crowd was just so much fun.
Oh my gosh, that was a wild fun crowd. Yeah,
it was a wild fun crowd.
Yeah,
and the audience, it was just one of those days. Like, I don't do a lot of crowd work, to be honest. Like,
yeah,
but it was just one of those days where it's like,
oh, you everything totally the
crowd said just got funnier and funnier and funnier. Like, It's honestly my favorite thing in the world, but it's the most nerve-wracking thing when you're on stage. Yeah. Is that moment where you're like, oh no, I'm not going to get through one joke while I'm up here. Like, throw the script away. This has turned into a variety show. Let's go for it. Man and his wife, the guy on the back. It was just so much going on that day. And then after you guys got on stage, the way people reacted to that, it was just, it was like, I think I was supposed to do 40,
yeah.
30, 45, something like that. I was supposed to do enough of a time that I could have supposed to tell jokes. And when I looked up, I was getting the light. And I was like, wait, I just got up here. I just said hello. When did 40 minutes pass? And it was like, no, we've been here for 40 minutes.
I know. Okay. Yeah, it was so fun. It went by so fast. That was so great.
Yeah, that's one of those shows that you're like, you know, if I had a chance to relive a night, that's one of those, like, I would certainly go back and try to have fun with you guys again. I know that's what we'll be doing March 28th. Like, I can already feel like, oh man, this is the kind of, when we all get together, this is what happens.
Yeah, it's going to be so good. And I'm so excited and pumped that your caliber of talent is coming here and these incredible experiences that you've had. You've also written for The Problem with Jon Stewart. What in the world? How did you land this? What is that experience like? You're a writer, so want to know about that, and then specifically what your role looks like. What's a typical task of a writer? I don't even know what that life is like. So peel the curtain back and tell us about that a little bit. First, how did you land it? First, how did you get this? Yeah.
Sure. And I will try to keep this under 3 days. So, all right, here's the thing. Here's the worst part. It's the one thing about storytelling that is always funny to me, but I do it too. It's like when a story starts off with something that makes no sense. So I'm going to do that right now.
All right.
I moved from DC to LA. We moved here in 2018, my wife and I. We moved from DC to LA in 2018. Mm-hmm. And we started over. And we didn't know many people here career-wise. I was starting over. I was starting from scratch, like getting in all the clubs, like truly starting from scratch. And, you know, it was just like me going to clubs and being like, I was on Last Comic Standing. And they're like, everybody was getting it back in the But so in that time, I think I really did not handle it well. In the sense of like, I had a cognitive understanding that I was starting over, but I just wasn't in a place where I could embrace it. It was just like, you know, going from DC where I was, you know, headlining.
The king of the mountain at that point, right? Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just like, it's jarring being in a place where you're really at the bottom of a different ladder. Mm-hmm. And at least at the time, it was just, I don't think I was prepared for it. So every time someone called me to come back to DC, I was flying back.
I remember that too. I was like, this boy is going back and forth. The East and West Coast a lot.
People were like, are you okay? When are you moving to LA? And I'm like, oh no, I live in LA. They're like, every time I come to this restaurant, you're here. So how did you move? And like, it was like that. It was like that often where I had to keep reminding people that I moved, but I think it was just in a place where I wasn't ready to let what I had in DC go. And that went on for about a year. And at the top of 2020, my wife was like, hey, we moved from everyone we know and love. Like, maybe we should start investing here. And that was in January of 2020. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to invest in LA. And then in February, everything shut down. Which was such a wild experience because in February, I finally started to like, all right, let me introduce myself to people and do all the nasty work, put my hand in the mud, like the stuff that you have to go to clubs and hang out and show your face and the yada, yada, build relationships. And in February, I finally got into Laugh and Skull Festival in Atlanta.
I was going to perform for the Stellar Awards comedy show.
Nice.
And I had gotten a headline one-nighter at the La Jolla Comedy Store in San Diego.
Nice. Yeah.
And in one day, they all got shut down because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
Like, it literally, in one day, everyone was like, we're so excited. Everything is shut down. And truly, like, one of the hardest times in my life, because it's like, it was, I truly quit comedy like four times in 2020. Mm-hmm. Being like, all right, Lord, I only need but so many signs.
You know what I mean? This door, like, seems to be closed. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, yeah, yeah.
I think so many artists and even people in general have that moment of like, is this the, what is the gray area between he'll never put more on me than I can bear? Mm-hmm. And just like an obvious, like, how many times does God need to show you this is not the right way?
Mm-hmm.
So like, so I was like, all right, Lord, well, I'm going to try to just go until the end of the year and then I'm just going to like quit. So all of 2020, I'm like doing virtual shows. Mm-hmm. I'm doing outdoor shows. The one fortunate part about LA is that the weather's so nice that year round you can do like outdoor shows.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they got huge. And we're talking like 200, 300 people weekly.
That's amazing. Coming. Like, they're great. Doing like
shows. Yeah. Because people are looking for things to do.
Mm-hmm.
You're in the house all day. You've gotten to the end of Netflix. Like, there's nothing else to watch.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, so like, the, you can't watch The Office, but so many times. Like,
yeah.
Get out. So people were like outside, and it became like a good comedy environment because people were like outside and doing stuff. So finally I was like, well, if I can't go out and network, maybe this was like a great time to meet people because it's like an equalizer. Everyone's in the house.
Yeah.
So I went on Facebook and found a group called Connect the Writers. Another example of like, I cannot take credit for all this stuff. I found a group called Connect the Writers. They were having weekly Zoom meetings with Hollywood writers and comedians to like get to know each other. Because it was like, hey, the industry's but so big, but sometimes it can just feel impossible. Mm-hmm. But if we're all in the house, like, maybe we can all like encourage each other and push each other. And hey, you know, like, you got to leave with the pandemic with a pilot, like write a new idea, like push yourself creatively, even though it's like probably a time the least we want to be creative. So they had, I got this group and I started doing weekly Zoom meetings and we met each other and, you know, it was just great meeting people. Oh, after the pandemic, we gotta get out with each other and yada, yada, yada. What I didn't know is another part of the group is that they would also send out the opportunities of like, hey, this is a grant or hey, this is a whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I got an email one day being like, hey, there's an untitled John Stewart project and they're taking submissions. And because the whole group was just like, hey, you got to write, you got to push yourself. Mm-hmm. I got that email and I was just using the packet as a writing exercise. It was the first packet I had ever worked on. It was the first packet. And I didn't even plan to submit it. I just wanted to use it as a writing exercise. Like, oh, this would be a great writing exercise. It's out of my comfort zone. Like, you know, I'm going to just do it. So I did the packet. I wasn't even going to send it off.
Really?
I was just so happy that I had like worked on like a Hollywood late night
project.
Yeah. It was just like, oh, I'm, because in the group they were like encouraging you to like write and push yourself creatively. So I was like, oh, John Stewart is not somebody that I'm going to write for ever.
Mm-hmm.
So like, let me just use the packet as a way to like
and
write.
Stretch yourself.
And stretch. And like, I'm going to stretch myself. And my wife was like, well, if you did the packet, you did it. You might as well just send it. And I was like, well, there's no point in sending it. I'm not going to get it. And she's like, well, if you're not going to get it, just send it.
Yeah.
Like, just like send it off.
Doesn't matter. I'm not going to get it.
So I sent it off. And almost exactly the same as the last Comic Standing thing. Didn't hear anything back. Went about my life. Whatever. We buy a house. We buy a house in January of 2021. I submit the packet in February. Maybe a month later, I get an email like, congratulations, welcome to round two of the John Stewart project.
Wow. Wow.
In my mind,
yeah,
that was my career achievement.
Yeah. You'd have been good with that.
Never considered myself to be a writer. Never thought of myself as a writer. I always, and mind you, remember, I'm coming from Howard. Mm-hmm. I studied acting and it led into comedy. I'm only thinking about myself as a performer. Mm-hmm. I'm never thinking about myself as an actual writer. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, oh man, someone with Jon Stewart thinks my writing was good enough to make it to round two. That's it. So I asked my wife, like, should I do round two? And at that point, I think she had to stop herself from being like, you're an idiot. Like, what is wrong? Like, I know as a, like, I know wives have that moment where you're like, I have to protect his ego. Right. But like, I know in her prayer time, she's like, Lord, help me with this idiot. Like, why do, like, there's so many other things I can encourage you to do. Why am I telling you, like, why are you making me use my wifeness on the obvious stuff?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You made so round two, Kason.
Yeah, like you did. Just like stop being stupid and just do it.
Yeah.
So I did round two, send it off. And then like a week later, it was like, hey, we want you to do round three. And I was like, that was the first time where I was like, wait, is this a thing? Like, am I actually being considered? Did round three. And the next day, they were like, hey, we want to do interviews for people who we want to interview for the job, like actual Zoom interview. And I did the Zoom interview. It was with our EP and our head writer at the time.
What's an EP and, for people who don't know?
Oh, you, executive producer.
All right.
I did an interview with the executive producer and our head writer at the time.
Yeah.
Chelsea Devantes. And maybe a couple of days later, I got a DM from the EP being like, hey, is it too soon to congratulate you? And I was like, congratulate me on what? And then she, and then I just got, this is a funny, I got a message back saying, oops. And, you know, just like as an artist, you know, being in the industry, just, I think there's all such a temptation for you to be pessimistic.
Yeah.
I was like, Lord, if there's somebody else whose name starts with K who she meant to send this to, this will really hurt.
Yeah.
But I got an email saying like, hey, we want to give you a call. And that's when they let me know that I had made the show and that they were excited for me to be a staff writer on the show. And the reason why I said I got the house in January is because I got the house in January. I submitted in February. I got the call that last week of March and maybe on a Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
And we started the show on Zoom on Monday.
That's quick. Very fast. Yeah.
Yeah. It was like, hey, like we start next week. Here's the Zoom link. Like that's how fast it happened. And we started on Zoom. We were on Zoom from April. And then they were like, we need you to report live in June, and had to pick up and go to New York and kind of make a little life there. And yeah, it was one of the most magical moments of my life, and all because I, not just my wife pushed me, but just because I wanted to meet people in this great organization, kind of locked in with these opportunities and started writing for Jon Stewart from there.
That's crazy. So you bought the house. So why you're pointing that out is you just bought a house, but then you're working in New York now. Once you get So did the you maintain? Go ahead.
The day that they called me to say I got the job, while they were saying congratulations, our couch was getting delivered. Like that's how conversion, like the, it was a wild time.
So did you do like dual residences and go back and forth from LA to New York? So you had a second place in New York that you had, or do you still have?
No. So at the time, my wife's job was still in Los Angeles. So I had to go to New York. Fortunately, I'm from Jersey City. So I was able to like put a little life together there so that we can sort of coexist on both coasts. But yeah, figuring that out was a lot. For a lot of the writers too, like, you know, like a lot of the writers are like, one of our writers, I won't say her name, but Well, no, I guess it's not, it's public knowledge, but Takara Mallard, she was pregnant at the time. Mm. She was 8 months pregnant. So when we started the job, like, she had to pick up and move to New York, like, 8 months pregnant, and had the baby like early on in the show. Like, it was just like, it's during the pandemic. So we're like, we do like COVID testing every day. And it was just like, it was like such a wild time. Like, it was another writer who had lived in LA who had to like pick up and find an apartment within like a week. So, I mean, the show was really gracious. John was amazing about it, but it was also just like, probably one of the most unsure times in our country. And then during that time, like, having to like move from where we were to New York was like such a wild time. But, you know, when you get an opportunity like that, you make it work.
You make it work. And what's a writing job look like when you work on a show like that? Is, you know, 9 to 5 Monday through Friday, or
nine to five Monday through Friday.
It is. Okay. Yeah. All
right. 9 to 5 Monday through Friday. And, you know, there are hundreds of ways that I can say that John and Chelsea were ideal bosses. But one of them is that, you know, most of our staff were like active stand-up comedians, which is why we were on the job, like amazing stand-up comedians. And John was like John and Chelsea were very, very adamant about like, hey, at 5 o'clock, leave and go do shows.
That's like, great.
Like, so everyone was just like out and about, like doing shows at night and coming in and doing our time. Because I think John thought what I think everyone in that space should think, which is like, the better you become as a stand-up comedian, the better you'll be here as a writer. So like,
that's right. And John Stewart was a stand-up too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So he completely understands and gets it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For sure. He really got it. And yeah, so it's like Monday through Friday. You know, John is like a genius.
Mm-hmm.
So he honestly could write that show by himself if he wanted to. Like, he could write anything by himself if he really wanted to. But yeah, I mean, we were involved from everything from like pitching episodes to writing episodes to writing sketches to co-hosting the podcast to, you know, helping frame like interview questions, looking up guests for the podcast. Like, we had our hands in so many things. Like, he really did encourage us to feel and look like producers that we were. I mean, we had great producers on the show, but he also gave us like so much leeway to bring what we were to the show.
Yeah. So I guess you performed then in New York City. You performed at the Comedy Cellar a few times, I imagine.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's like, yeah.
Yeah, it's being in New York was incredible. And New York Comedy Club became like my home at the time. But I was blessed to be in so many stages while I was there. It was crazy.
I bet you felt like you grew a lot too during that time. As a writer and as a comic in that kind of environment, is that correct? Does that feel correct?
100%. Like, you know, I think one of the things that I appreciate most about my time at Howard is that something about studying a craft and an art around so many other talented artists teaches you about how much like iron sharpens iron.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I just always naturally brought that into stand-up as well. And not just like John, but all the other writers, I learned so much. Like, I feel like completely different. The way I describe it is like, I feel like I'm a keyboard player at my church. Mm-hmm. And then I got to tour with Stevie Wonder. Like, that's
wow. That's a good picture. Like. Yeah.
Like, and it's not that one is better than the other, but I mean, obviously, but I think it was just, you got to learn and be exposed to somebody who's been doing it on such a high level for so long. And it was this, I feel like I grew exponentially as an artist, as an individual, as a person, as a man, in that whole experience. It's hard to quantify.
Yeah. I'm excited for you just to even hear what you were able to experience. Feels like a blessing. So thanks for sharing that. Then you did Netflix is a Joke Festival After that, where does that piece of your story fit in? Is the Netflix is a joke festival in terms of your career timeline?
Sure. So this is last year.
Well, that's recent. Okay.
Yeah. Last year I did Netflix as a joke festival. It was truly a, wow. So I was, okay.
Okay.
This single podcast is probably ensuring that I'm never going to write a book because I'm just saying everything today. But so if anybody out there wonders why I never wrote a book, it's because I said it.
We'll get you an AI tool. They'll transcript it.
All the laughers got it first. Yeah. Yeah. So
yeah,
I was at home in New Jersey. We were off that day for some reason. And I got the call that I was going on tour with Wanda 30 minutes before I found out I had made it to Netflix as a joke festival.
Oh my goodness.
Same exact day. So much so that like my wife was in LA at the time and I texted her. I was like, yo, call me right now. And I was like, I'm going on tour with Wanda. And she was like, like she's screaming all the, like the same scream I let out the government building. She let that out. And then like a half an hour later, she was like, hey, I'm in a meeting. Can I call you back? And, she went back in a meeting and then I texted her again, like, I need you to leave the meeting. And
she was like, what now?
She was like, it was just like so innocent, but she was like, in the nicest wife way possible, she was like, babe, I'm excited about Wanda Sykes too, but this is a really important board meeting. And I was like, no, I got Netflix as a joke festival. And then she like let out the bigger scream than the first one. Yeah, Netflix as a joke festival was so much fun. It was so amazing to be a part of. It was my first time being a part of a festival in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And I got to like open up for a good friend of mine, Jay Jordan. I got to do like showcase shows for like Sydney Castillo and the Kookaburra Lounge. Like I met so many amazing people during that time. So many people I had met during a diverse representation festival. It was just such an amazing show. And I got to hang with John. John Stewart did a show at the Greek Theater, which I didn't perform for. Like Josh Johnson opened up that show and a bunch of other people. But it was my first time seeing John since the show had ended. So it was like hanging out with John was so much fun. And I had just flown back from New York. So the festival started on May the 2nd. May the 2nd, I was in New York hosting the Apollo Theater.
And then I flew
back to LA to do the festival. And then over that week, got to do like 3 or 4 shows on the festival. And it was just like, you know, it's like one of those things where, you know, like I do a show and let's say it's like completely sold out other than like 3 seats. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, man, I thought this show was going to sell out. Why is it not selling out? And it's like, oh, because Kevin Hart's across the street. Wow. It's like, oh, yeah. Okay. It's yeah. Those 3 people went across the street.
I get it now.
Totally. Yeah. So it was like that. It was just, it's like every big name in comedy was there. And it, just being a part of that was so humbling and so inspiring and amazing. And I hope to do it again this year.
Oh, I hope you do. I'm going to be cheering you on. That's incredible.
Me too.
You got all these great things going on, and you, your comedy is deeply personal, and I'm wondering how you balance your humor with sharing your own journey. So you have, for example, in the show that we did together, you have a brand, a sweatshirt, and it's Generational Curse Breaker. And I have my own, you know, trauma background with CPTSD as a result of that. So I had to have that sweatshirt for 2 reasons. 1, because it's your sweatshirt. And 2, because it was meaningful to me and I in my own way. But I would love to hear why how you came up with that brand, why it's meaningful for you, and how that intertwines with your comedy material.
Sure. Another great question. I think, again, it's like something that I would have to first credit, like, thank God that I was able to process a lot of the stuff that has happened in my life. I don't think a lot of people have a chance to process what goes on in their life. Mm-hmm. And I've been blessed with opportunity to be in comedy and have professionally, like, it's my job to think about myself and my life and everything that goes on. So I'm blessed to, like, be able to process those things. Two, I honestly have to say, like, again, that's another thing I would credit to Howard. I think one of the big things about studying acting, I always say, like, I think every single comedian should actively study, pursue mm-hmm. acting.
Yeah, that's my background before this too. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I told you, Virginia Comics, y'all do like 80 things before y'all do comedy. I promise you, if you say you are astronaut, I would believe you. You're like, yeah, I went to the moon, and I'll be back on March 28th to do the show. Like, that thing, like, that's how much. But I think acting for the stage,
yeah,
is so critical to any artists, specifically comedians, because it's always studying not just the lines and how things should be said, mm-hmm. but living a life that makes the lines live. Mm-hmm. And I think that everything that I do in comedy is just acting. And the only reason why I think comedy stood out to me is because I always thought of it as everything that I was learning in acting, but I get to write my own script. Mm. Like, that's kind of how I've always thought about it. Like, I get to do all the things that I love in acting. I just get to, like, be in control of what's being said and get to have my own messages in it and yada, yada, yada. But yeah, it's really just acting, in the sense that when I think about, a lot of my comedy doesn't start with what I think is funny.
Mm-hmm.
It's really what I think is out of place.
Interesting.
So, like, even with Generational Curse, like, it was honestly, a lot of it was just thinking through my process and journey and obstacles of defining manhood for myself. Like, I always thought, like, if college, and this has happened in my career, and that's like one of the things I'm most proud of, honestly, is my stand-up made it into someone's dissertation. It's like, I got an email one day being like, hey, I used your joke for my dissertation. And I was like, like, it was because I always thought, like, some of my favorite things in stand-up, like, some of my favorite jokes, if you read them on paper,
mm-hmm.
I'm like, not that I don't want it to be funny. Like, I want to be very, very clear.
Okay.
The idea of comedy is to be funny. Like, I always want to be funny.
Yeah.
But some of my favorite jokes, if you read them on paper, they could start a discussion that is, like, real.
Mm.
And that's something that I always wanted. Not that I want to bring people down with, like, real conversation. Like, I don't want people to hear me on stage and be like, I didn't think it was funny, but boy, did you get my mind wondering. Like, I don't want
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no.
No, but I do want to start from, like, an actual real place.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I never thought that, like, growing up without a father was funny. Like, it's never like, oh boy, let me tell you about growing up without a dad. Here we go.
Yeehaw. Like,
right. You know what I mean? Like,
I got you. Woo. Yeah.
I feel bad for anybody who does comedy with two parents. Like, that's not. It's like, no, that's not how it
lucky
works at all.
Me.
Right.
I'm going to go buy my lottery ticket right now.
Right. Right. You know what I mean? Two parents and four grandparents. Good luck. Ugh.
Who's winning now?
Right. 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 Get out, Dad. I'm trying to pursue this as a career. So it was never like that. And I think that's a big reason why I think people connect to it, is because I'm not trying, you know, I think it can be formed and shaped into something that is presentable in a comedy space, but it really is like starting off with, like, anything you hear me say on stage is something that I've talked to God about. It's something that I've talked to friends about. It's something I've talked to a counselor and therapist and people about. It's something I talk to my family about. So I think that's why people are like, man, I was just thinking about that. And it's like, so was I. Yeah. And I always like challenge myself to perform from a place of realism and try to like say what I really feel and all of those things. But it's like you can make it funny. Like one thing that Al Freeman always said is like, you have to trust your instincts, but also like the joke isn't funny. Mm-hmm. You are. Mm. And I think I always like, oh yeah, I'm funny. So like and it's something like John always said, like it's like always been reinforced throughout my career of like, if you let yourself like be a part of it, it'll come off the way it's supposed to and people can enjoy it. But, and you're present in the moment, you're active, you know, you're there, like all of those things. Like the crowd doesn't know the script, only you do. Mm-hmm. It's your job to live it. Like, I think all of those things sort of add up into me approaching comedy, not from a place of like, hey, these are all the things that I have found funny. It's like, no, these are the things that I've found are out of place. And then this is how I present it to you. And you just have fun with it. And I think that's, I think that's how I approach everything from the darkest of subjects to just like observational stuff. It's kind of all through this filter of like, let me be honest. And then from there, it's like, we can all have fun.
Yeah. Which is a great segue into the next question. As you come into the Site Center on March 28th, and folks out there, get those tickets if you haven't bought them already. This is going to be a hella show. So that the Site Center and anywhere you perform, I would like for you to give some sort of just overall representation. We know kind of what your material is about. We've heard a little bit about your story. Now you're going to step out on stage at the Site Center, wherever you go. What can audience expect when you come out and grab the mic? What's your style? What's the feel? What can they expect?
You can expect to have fun. Like, I think, honestly, and this is what I would say to anybody who's in the area, anybody watching this, I don't care what you look like, what you sound like, what you believe in. If you buy a ticket, you will have fun. If you do not buy a ticket, you will be missing out on absolute fun. Yeah. Like it's gonna be like, people say like, what's your style? Like, I don't know, whatever it is that night. I honestly don't know yet. I will find out when you find out. But it's going to be a lot of fun. Like I don't know. Am I going to talk about relationships? Am I going to talk about politics? Am I going to talk about growing up in church? Am I going to talk about going to Howard? Am I going to talk about LA? Am I going to talk about Virginia? I don't know. Are we going to talk about the Womex kind of being astronauts and not telling anybody? Like, I don't know. I will find out when you find out. But I can absolutely promise you without a doubt, anytime they produce a show, it is A1 quality.
Thank you.
And I can tell you that all I'm bringing to it is it will be absolute fun. I want comedy shows to feel like game night. I want it to feel like a house party.
Me too.
I want it to feel like a family reunion. Like, that's what I want it to feel like. And that's what this one will feel like. Now, will the next one feel this? Yes. If they're producing it, absolutely. But I'm gonna be here for this one, and that's what I wanted to feel like. I want it to be. I think I can say without a shadow of a doubt, and there are only a few things I know in life, And one thing I know is if you buy a ticket to the show March 28th, you will have fun. That's the style I'm going for. I want people falling out of seats. I want to have a good time.
Oh, yeah. We have a good time. It's going to be a good time. And then they're going to want to stay in touch with you. They're probably going to want to follow you before then to see more about you and what Kason is doing and where he's going. They're going to want to follow you after March 28th. So how can the Laughers best get in touch with you on social media or otherwise to find out what you are up to and keep following your success?
Awesome. I just want to say for all the Laughers out there, you can follow me on social media. If you follow me in any other way, I will call the police. follow me on Instagram at The Life of K-A-Y, The Life of K-A-Y. And in any other way, you could just honestly search my name, Kason, K-A-S-A-U-N, because it's not that many of us. It's just me and a rapper, and his music. The music isn't that good. So if you find a Kason and he's rapping, that is not me. I do not support that. He does not speak for all Kasons in this world. But follow me at The Life of K-A-Y. All of my tour dates are on there. All of my dates are on there. Obviously, March 28th being one of the big ones that I'm looking forward to. And I'm on Twitter at The Life of K-A-Y. You can search Facebook, Comedian Kason Wilson. And anything else, just search Kason or The Life of K-A-Y. You'll find me on there.
Yeah, you will. Oh, Kason, thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing all those amazing stories. It's truly inspirational. And I couldn't be more blessed to have you on here today to share all of that, your humor and your wit and your incredible stories. Thanks again for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
You better believe it. And Laughers, thank you for tuning in to spend time with us today. It truly means so much from the bottom of my heart that you are following this podcast. It's growing amazingly, and it wouldn't grow without your support. So I want you to like, share, subscribe, share with a friend if you really enjoyed this, because we're going to bring more amazing episodes and other fun content through to you throughout the year. Also, remember, you can get the free audiobook on Audible. Just hit the hit. I was doing so good, Kason. We're down to the end.
You're still doing good. I'm enjoying this.
All right, one more time. Also, remember, you can get a free audiobook on Audible, and you can hit the link in the show notes to try out a 30-day trial to get that free audiobook. I am an Audible creator, so I earn a commission when you sign up through the link at no cost to you. But again, that supports this podcast so we can continue putting all this awesome content out there for you. And lastly, and most importantly, thanks for tuning in, Laughers. Out of all the podcasts out there, you picked us, and we think that's pretty darn special. Just like you. Until next time, keep smiling. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Virginia is for Laughers podcast, brought to you by the Funny Womack and Friends. We'll be dropping a new podcast every Wednesday, so check back for another uplifting episode. Come to a FWAF show or let us bring one to you. To find out more, head to thefunnywomacks.com. Be sure to share this podcast with a friend, and until next time, cheers.